Rewards, if they're big enough and juicy enough, can work to get one thing and only one thing ever: temporary compliance at a huge cost. You'll notice punishments and rewards are not two different items. They're two sides of the same coin. They're both about doing things to people, not about working with people. It's just that in the case of rewards, it's sugar-coated control. Now, what's the question the kid comes to ask? Instead of, what do they want me to do? What happens to me if I don't do it? It's, what do they want me to do? And what do I get for doing it? No improvement in the relationship between the reward giver and the reward recipient. Now we're not enforcers of harm. We're what, goody dispensers on legs, which is no closer to being a caring ally. And kids are still just as much focused on themselves. And the research bears this out.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today, I have a legend in the room. I'm not going to introduce him as per usual. I will let him introduce himself, and we'll get right into the conversation. Go ahead.
I'm Alfie Cohn. I write books and give lectures on a variety of topics having to do with parenting, education, and human behavior more generally. The most relevant books, I think, to what we're going to be talking about today are Unconditional Parenting and one called Punished by Rewards. And information about those, as well as a heap of free articles, are available on my website, which is just my name, alfiecohn.org.
Okay. And I will put that in the show notes for people who are looking for more information, because we're only going to touch on the topics that you go very, very deeply into in your books. So let me just general question, as we normally do. Why shouldn't we use rewards or punishment? Like, what's the kind of elevator pitch that you have for the case against rewards and punishment?
Well, let's assume we're taking an elevator to the top of a somewhat tall high rise here. Punishments consist of saying to people who have less power than we do, do what I tell you or I'm going to make you suffer. Of course, we're not saying it quite that way, but that's what a punishment is, a deliberate attempt to make people unhappy until they do what we like. Punishment can work to get one thing and only one thing ever, which is temporary compliance, but at a huge cost. So if I threaten to hurt you and it's a credible threat, as long as I'm around to carry that out, you'll do whatever I tell you or stop doing what I want. But the research indicates, as does I think our experience, if we're attentive to it, that the first thing it does is make somebody mad, because they're powerless, they've had their powerlessness shoved in their face, and they're being forced to do something they don't want. So now they're looking at us and at what we've made them do much more negatively. It warps our relationships with them. Now, if I'm a parent threatening to punish, or to use the preferred euphemism, employ a consequence, but it's a punishment, then they're about as happy to see us coming as you and I would be to see a police car in our rearview mirrors. Now we're not a caring ally. We're an enforcer to be avoided. The other thing that all punitive consequences does is focus the recipient's attention firmly on themselves. So the question they come to ask is, what do they want me to do? And what happens to me if I don't do it? So all punishments, regardless of the type or the way that they're implemented, make kids less concerned about the impact of their actions on other people, which is part of what it means to be a moral human beings, and more focused on what do I do and how do I escape the punishment. So if we say to kids, hey, I better not catch you doing that again, the kid thinks, okay, next time you won't catch me. You know, it does nothing to help them be reflective about what they did, why they did it, if there was a better thing they could have done, what the impact is on other people. It's all about power. They have it. I don't. Which is why kids who are raised in traditional households where they're punished, and it doesn't even have to be violent corporal punishment where we're literally hurting them, which teaches a message of violence above all. Any kind of punishment leads kids to learn, how can I make people who are weaker than I am capitulate? And sometimes they play out what they learn from their parents with weaker kids that same afternoon. So now we get to part two as we get to the 50th floor. Instead of saying, do this, or here's what I'm going to do to you, some parents think, well, I've got it all figured out. I'm not going to threaten them. I'll bribe them. I'll say to them, do this and you'll get that. Now it's a reward, not a punishment. What does the research say about that? Rewards, if they're big enough and juicy enough, can work to get one thing and only one thing ever. Temporary compliance at a huge cost. You'll notice punishments and rewards are not two different items. They're two sides of the same coin. They're both about doing things to people, not about working with people. It's just that in the case of rewards, it's sugar-coated control. Now, what's the question the kid comes to ask? Instead of, what do they want me to do? What happens to me if I don't do it? It's, what do they want me to do? And what do I get for doing it? No improvement in the relationship between the reward giver and the reward recipient. Now we're not enforcers of harm. We're what, goody dispensers on legs, which is no closer to being a caring ally. And kids are still just as much focused on themselves. And the research bears this out. Children who are frequently rewarded or praised, praise is just a verbal doggy biscuit. Good job. I like the way you, is just a different way of manipulating children. It's not about working with them. Or we use stickers or gold stars or desserts or A's or anything. When we're bribing them to obey, the research finds that kids become more self-centered, less likely to help and share and care. And rewards like punishments actually make kids less likely to become or remain interested in whatever they had to do to get the reward. So, for example, you reward kids for reading a book, give them a prize for reading a book, they instantly come to be less excited about reading because you've taught them that the only reason to read is you'll get biscuit, you'll get something for doing it. And the same thing explains why grades, we can talk about this more if you want, whenever kids are trying to get a good report card and parents are emphasizing that, they become less excited about learning than they were before, and as compared to kids who are lucky enough to go to schools where there are no grades. So anyway, that was a long elevator pitch, but there's scores of studies. I didn't make this stuff up in the shower this morning, indicating that rewards and punishments are not just ineffective, they're actively damaging. And it doesn't matter how you do it. The problem is with the whole outdated and inaccurate assumptions about motivation on which all rewards and punishments are based.
So it doesn't matter if we collaborate with the child on what the punishment or consequence should be?
No, that's screwing with their heads. That's making them an accomplice in our attempt to control them and giving the false message that, hey, it wasn't me. You had some role in it. You can think of methods like that where really devious and sometimes evil adults do that to other adults, you know, relinquishing responsibility and say, you know, you want me to hit you over the head with a bat or punch you in the stomach? You know, it's that's not meaningful choice or autonomy. Yeah. It's playing games we have to step back and ask why we're doing this in the first place.
Yeah. You know, and I'm not going to go back and forth about whether what you said was true or not, or what about this and what about that, because you have very comprehensively brought up all the arguments and all the studies in your book, Punish by Reward. So if you're out there listening and there's something that Alfie said where you're like, ah, I'm not so sure about that, and you haven't listened to the book or read the book, I highly recommend that you do that. I want to spend the rest of this time talking about, okay, so I believe what you said, right? Punishments and rewards are not helpful. They're actually, they can be harmful. And I want to do away with punishments and rewards in my parenting or my teaching practice. Okay. But now the next step is, okay, I'm not going to do that. But the next step is, what do we do instead? Because we live in a world that is entrenched in punishments and rewards. And this is not even just the outside environment. It's something that is ingrained and conditioned within us. So how do I, as a parent or as a teacher who still has to get from point A to point B, or get the lesson done, or get them dressed and go to schools, how do I actually put this into practice? What do I do instead? And how do I do it in a way that's I can start doing tomorrow, and hopefully start to see some kind of impact?
There isn't a simple script or formula or recipe. Part of what makes rewards and punishments so appealing, so seductive, even though experience and research demonstrate they're very counterproductive in the long run, is that they're easy. It doesn't take to dangle a goodie in front of a kid if they jump through our hoops, or to threaten to hurt them if they don't, takes no care, no time, no effort, no talent. To figure out how to solve problems together and to question what it is that we asked kids to do takes courage, takes care, talent, and all the rest of that stuff, which helps to explain, you know, why it is that rewards and punishments can persist, even though they keep making things worse. So let me return to that quick parenthetical that I just mentioned, what it is we ask kids to do. Most parenting books and classroom management resources for teachers, in effect, say to the adult, whatever you want kids to do is automatically legitimate. Mm. Now, here are some tricks and techniques to get them to do it. And those are very popular, those books, you know, those workshops and so on. I, on the other hand, and a number of other people say, a lot of times when kids in school are off task, the problem is with the task. And that takes some courage for us to take a step back and say, I have to be bribed into filling out worksheets every day too. The problem's not with the lack of motivation on the part of the kid. The problem is worksheets, which do not bring kids in on thinking in a meaningful way. If the task is problematic, if the goal is questionable, then even the nicest method isn't going to be sufficient. Nor is it enough to simply confine our conversation to thinking about what do we do instead as a technique, when what we need to do is ask whether the curriculum is engaging and how much say the kids had in devising that curriculum. Mm-hmm. You don't need to bribe and threaten kids when they participated in deciding what they were going to learn and how and when and with whom. And the teacher was doing a lot more asking and a lot less telling. Now the kids are excited. The only reason that people say it's unrealistic to do without bribes and threats is because they have accepted a doing to approach to both curriculum, what they're learning, and pedagogy, how they're learning, and simply are looking for a technique to make kids obey. Most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time when teachers talk about kids with problems with motivation, they're not really talking about motivation at all. They're talking about obedience. Mm-hmm. All rewards, from stickers to grades to good job, and all punitive consequences, are in the business of getting obedience, not helping kids to become good, caring people, not helping them to become independent thinkers, not helping them to become critical thinkers and learners who are curious. It's all about compliance. That's why it's not so easy to say, here's what else you do. Much of this applies to parents at home as well. When kids don't do what we tell them, the first response should be to think about what we've told them. In many cases, it may be a perfectly reasonable demand. It really may be about their safety. It may be about something that's non-negotiable. But a lot of times it's something for our convenience, where we've skipped over the step of whether it makes sense, whether it's developmentally appropriate for kids of this age to sit still for this long, or to remember the promise that they supposedly made, or whatever. Yeah. You know, we skip over that step and say, if I can't bribe or threaten them, give me another technique to make them do whatever I told them.
Mm.
And in my book, Unconditional Parenting, the second half of the book is more about how we bring kids in on decision-making, support their autonomy, question our requests, look at things from a different point of view, namely their point of view. And in that way, when a problem comes up, and kids do something that's mean or that's dishonest or that troubles us, we see it as a problem to be solved together, not as an infraction to be punished. And it's more about how we help them increasingly to take responsibility for what they're doing. And by the way, one clear indication that we're on the wrong track and we're inevitably going to be resorting to more bribes and threats is if we keep focusing on kids' behavior. Whenever I hear that word emphasized a lot, I worry. Because now you're just looking at the surface,
mm-hmm.
at the actions that can be seen and measured. And as soon as it's all about extinguishing or reinforcing a behavior, making kids act this way, you're probably going to resort to some kind of reward or punishment to get the behavior you want. What matters are the motives and the reasons and the values inside the inside experience that inform the behavior. The more you talk about behavior, the more you're going to act like a behaviorist and ignore the kid who engages in the behavior. That's not just disrespectful. It's counterproductive in a practical sense.
Let's talk about, you mentioned, you said, don't skip over the step of really assessing what our demands are. And it's a reasonable demand, or is it developmentally appropriate? Is the lesson engaging? Let's talk about those demands that we don't skip over the step. And we say, this is, I believe it to be reasonable that, you know, you can cohabitate this space and not hurt someone else or not say hurtful things to another person.
Okay. Right?
Or, maybe it's reasonable for us to, for you to go to school and for me to go to work, right? We've kind of deemed that as something that's reasonable. And you can use these examples or use another example, but can you kind of give us a practical, maybe example of what that could look like and what that could sound like? I know it's not going to be the same for every single situation, but give us an example of what it could look like and sound like.
Let's take your first example where it's perfectly reasonable and even important for kids not to hurt somebody else. So the question is, what do we really care about here? If our goal is just to make kids stop hurting others while there's an adult looking, if the goal is the behavior or getting rid of that behavior, then, and we don't care about the reason for it, then we might threaten kids with a punishment. I mean, sadly, you actually see parents, you know, who catch their kids being hurtful and slapping them, you know? We don't hit people. I mean, the irony would be hilarious if it weren't so tragic. You're teaching children to hit people. When you use your overwhelming power, you're making them into a violent person, and you're undermining their capacity to become moral people who won't want to hit others, even when you're not around.
Yeah.
And so the question then becomes, how do you engage children's conscience so that they come to construct a sense of themselves as the kind of people who wouldn't want to hurt others? When you use a consequence, you're emphasizing, as I said before, that what matters is only the consequence to themselves. If you punish them for hurting or reward them for not hurting, they never think in terms of why you shouldn't hurt someone else. They're only thinking about what happens to me if I'm caught by somebody with more power hurting someone else. So in a practical sense, what we can do is help fix their attention on the kid whom they have hurt. Now, I'm talking about younger children here. Obviously, you would reframe this for older students or older children. But I might say something like, you know, look at Derek's face crying right now. He looks really very unhappy. You remember when you tripped last week and in the stairs and you hurt your knee and you were crying like that? That may be how he's feeling now. How do you think you could help him feel better? So you're inducing children to pay attention to others and the impact of their action on others. And by the way, exactly the same thing is true if, let's say, your kid shares her brownie with another kid. The last thing we want to do is just this sort of patronizing pat on the head. Good job. I really like the way you shared. You're such a generous person. She just became a little less likely to share when you're not around to pat her on the head. You've made her more self-centered. And that's what the research shows, by the way. Instead, I will do the flip side of the example I gave a moment ago, which is, look at Diane's face there, happily chewing. She loves brownies. You know, it looks like you made her pretty happy. And then I might even follow that up with a question. You like brownies too. How'd you decide to share it with her? Which helps kids to focus on, yeah, why did I do that? It makes them think about their motives as well as the impact on other people, as opposed to all punishments and all rewards, which are all about self-centeredness. So in this case, I'm agreeing with you. The goal is great, to not hurt, and indeed, not only to fail to hurt, but to proactively help and share and care. But you can never reach those goals with any kind of punishment or reward. What we have to do is think of a way to move beyond and beneath the behavior in order to help kids reflect on the kind of people they are. That would go for just about anything that meets your test where we're absolutely convinced it's a good thing. Although I'll give a quick caveat to your second example, which is you gotta go to school, you know, as yes, there is a law that says you have to go to school, and it is very convenient for parents when kids go to school, and we hope that they will benefit from going to school. But if a kid is showing persistent aversion to going to school, I'm not going to start by saying, what technique can I use to make the kid go if I'm not allowed to use punishments and rewards? I'm going to start by looking and listening very carefully to treat the kid's resistance seriously and respectfully to see if something is going on at school such that I wouldn't want to go there either. And that's a problem I may have to help solve.
Could it be true in that second example that the child is just really connected to the adult, to the parent, and the thought of kind of transitioning from being where you're safe at home and comfortable with your parent who you love the most, to going to school where things are a little bit more unpredictable. And maybe there are, there are likely punishments and rewards happening at the school. I think it's rare that I hear that there's a school that aren't using some kind of form of punishments or rewards. What would you do in that situation? Maybe you even assess that, like, okay, they're not feeling 100% comfortable at school and they're really connected to me. What would be your next step?
Well, let's distinguish the first part of that question from the second. In the second part, you talked about stuff that understandably would make any reasonable person want to stay away, namely being bribed or threatened into mindless obedience. That series of practices or policies at a given school, while I agree with you, sadly, are widespread, that's not like the weather. That's not a fact of life to which we have to accommodate ourselves. That's a serious problem for all the kids, not just my own. And so while I'm doing stopgap measures, interim solutions to try to minimize the damage and help my kids survive that, I'm going to be organizing and mobilizing with other parents to treat that as a problem to be solved. And I'm going to help engage with teachers and principals in a respectful but pointed way, sharing books, articles, videos about how this stuff is not necessary and not desirable for kids. And there's different ways to do that, depending on how strongly you feel, what your tolerance for risk is, and what kind of relationship you have with the educators you're talking about. By the way, for every email I get from a parent saying, I'm trying to do what you suggest at home, and then I send my kid to school where they're, you know, being treated like pets, you know, being trained with stickers and gold stars and grades and so on. For every email I get like that, I get another one from a teacher who says, we're trying to create working with caring classroom communities. And then I send the kids home where they're being spanked, you know, or where they're being bribed in various ways. And I don't want to bash teachers or parents. I want to bring them all together and introduce them all to this thinking and research so we can do what's best for them at home and at school. So, but the first part of your question is, all right, let's assume that's not going on and in the classroom. And it's just that they love us, want to spend time with us, had trouble with transitions, don't want to go somewhere else, especially at the beginning of the year when it feels unfamiliar. In that case, you know, I would say we work with the kid to figure out transitions, to listen to their concerns, and to give them as much autonomy as possible within the constraints that we have, where ultimately you have to go to school. Every other aspect of that that is possible, we're going to let them decide. How can I help becomes our mantra. You know, would it help if I walk you in, or would you like to go in by yourself? Yeah. Would it help if we waited a few minutes today and you went in a little late, and I'll explain to the teacher because today it seems like you're having a hard time with this, or do you think you'll be ready? Would it help if we snuggled for a little bit right before we go? And if so, where do you want to do that? And, you know, should we do it with a snack? You want to do it with your favorite stuffed animal? Whatever choice you can give them about it, and then you explain and you listen. So you maximize the autonomy even when there are constraints, which is true, I think, in general, not just by going to school.
So I have one last question, and I want to, and it's going to be a quick one, but have you heard of conscious discipline before?
Have I heard of, I'm sorry?
It's a program, a social emotional learning program called conscious discipline. Have you heard of it before?
Conscious discipline. There are so many blank discipline programs, some of which I think are kind of on the right track and I like, and others of which are hideous, but have names that make them sound more appealing. Like there's one that makes my skin crawl called Love and Logic. And there's a bunch of others too, Discipline with Dignity, which I can't stand. And so I don't know about the conscious discipline. I can't keep up with all of them.
Yeah.
I wrote a book a while ago for teachers called Beyond Discipline that has a couple of chapters just about these, what I call new discipline programs. And I can't keep up with all of them to say, I think this is a good one, this is a bad one, this one is half right. And what I try to do is offer the basic criteria for what makes sense, a vocabulary of doing to versus working with, conditional versus unconditional acceptance. Here's why rewards and punishments don't make sense, no matter what euphemism we use for them. You know, to what we ought to call forcible isolation of children when they need us most is instead called time out.
Yeah.
These are ways of making us feel better about making kids feel bad. So I lay out the nuts and bolts of what I think is problematic and what makes more sense, and then leave it to my listeners and my readers to apply those criteria when they come across a new program and say, well, let's look at conscious discipline. You know, has it completely gotten rid of punishments and rewards, or does it just call them by a different name? Is it really questioning the idea of obedience as the absolute be-all of our goals? Or is it really about bringing kids in a substantive way, not just letting them feel that they're participating, et cetera, et cetera? So I don't know about that one, but some of what's done in the name of social and emotional learning, I think, is pretty cool. Yeah. And pretty respectful of kids, and other stuff uses that label, and it makes me very worried.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty familiar with your work, and I'm pretty familiar with conscious discipline work. I'm just going to throw, I know you, there's millions of programs out there, but I'm just going to be one person to kind of just throw it out there that the conscious discipline does align with what you're saying. And if it's, and encourage you to maybe look into it. And if it's something that you do agree on and does align with what you have research and talk about and preach, that it might be something that you offer to, especially those in the early childhood field. I think it applies, isn't it? It's really more about the adult changing, being conscious enough to, or being disciplined enough to set and achieve goals, being conscious enough to know when you're off track, and being connected enough to be willing to change. I'm just going to throw that out there in hopes that maybe 5 or 6 other people in the course of the next year might mention it. And it might be something that we can spread more, because we really do need more about what to do instead. And I'll end it on that. If there's anything else you would like to say, you can say it. If not, I will end it right here. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you, Alfie. I appreciate your work, and have a great day.
Thank you. I appreciate your interest.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?